Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most wordy and righteous work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming at you live in the Discord.
Hey, hey. Thanks to everyone who's come along to listen to us live. So yeah. We get into the 17th arc.
Well, let's do it. But first, one last chapter of Left in the Dust. 16.Z, we're with the bug snacks, I guess, is what we'll call them.
Yeah, Basil's bug snacks.
Starting with the history of the Turtle Queen, a group of images that got a bit too big for its boots.
I love this little, I mean, this is what the interludes are always great at, right? Like this little horror story sort of vibe. Like this is just the origin story of like a terrifying horror monster that could carry like a movie franchise.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I love the way this evolves, like, because it is just kind of like fun at the start.
Yeah.
With like, oh, it's like a mural that's also on some shirts that's kind of come to life or gaining, you know, some level of sentience. And it's really delightful. And then it becomes very, very horrifying quite quickly.
Yeah. Oh, and it's interesting because the reason it becomes terrible is like people, because the guy slaps the student or whatever.
Yes.
And that's what fuels it. And really that fuel is coming from anger. So the Turtle Queen comes out angry and shitty because of people.
Yeah. I mean, I love that it's like tying into this idea of it's a moral righteousness kind of, you know, like a,
yeah,
like anger based on I can't believe this situation has happened. Like it's, you know, it's based around morality, which is very fun based on the way that this chapter goes. Yeah. and kind of the questions it asks.
Yeah, it is, for want of a better word, bridging the space between arcs 16 mm-hmm. and 17.
Yeah, beautiful.
But no, because we saw an origin story pretty similar to the Turtle Queen's, which was Faceful in arc 13.
Mm.
Like the big face in the Carmine contest. He started off as like, oh, this face appeared in a video game and somewhere else. I can't remember the details, but like,
yeah,
I get the impression he was basically the same thing, but he was just like, you know, our innocent fun dude. Like,
yeah,
he just wanted to make friends.
Well,
so I think
because gamers are so chill.
No, well, it was an indie game. It's fine. But yeah, like, I mean, you know, it was, he seemed to come from a really nice place. Really, the only thing that separates him and the Turtle Queen was basically the reason they went viral and the stuff behind it. So, like, it's kind of society's fault at the end of the day.
Mm. Yep.
And I think that's why this works really well as, like, the follow-on to 16.Y, because Millie's interlude was all about how the system was causing good practitioners to fail and become corrupted. And then this chapter comes in as a follow-up to remind us that, hey, most others are inspired by or come from humanity. So when the system's making all the people fail, that, like, you know, that part trickles down, and then, you know, all the others come out of the gates swinging, like, violently.
Yeah, I like that. It's a reflection of humanity.
Yeah, exactly. And Lapse Classicist has brought up a great point in the chat, which is like, this is essentially Lyssa's argument as well, that she came out fucking miserable because she was at like a girls' boarding school or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, I guess that starts to tie into all this stuff about where personal responsibility fits in.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is the theme of next arc.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll get to talk about this a lot more in arc 17.
So yeah, the Turtle Queen becomes more and more violent in an effort to expand her reach. Eventually, finally, practitioners take notice and Basil binds her.
Yeah, thank God we have people like Basil in the world taking care of this stuff. Am I right?
Yeah,
thank God for practitioners.
The Turtle Queen is like evil, right? Like, it actually, on my second read through, it actually was surprising to me how much they were talking about Bridge as the moral question when I was like, the Turtle Queen is so much worse than Bridge. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I put the Turtle Queen on par with the Milkmaid in terms of others that I'm like, I'm not comfortable associating with this other.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I have to agree, because her, the way she just takes over people and spaces is just horrifying, and we see a bit of how she thinks about it here, and it's scary. I mean, it reminds me a lot of our conversations around John, and I think like the stuff we're going to be talking about a lot in this episode, and presumably Arc 17, a lot of it is tying back to the conversations we used to have about John half the story ago, where it was like he was shaped by the people he killed, and the Turtle Queen has been shaped by the people she absorbs and the energy she got. So it's like she was set up to fail, but also she's turned into just a terrifying sociopathic monster.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, the concept of she's clearly at her core very, very much a product of just like, you know, the society that built her. But even so, God, horrifying. Yeah. Horrifying.
I mean, like, this is the thing, right? Like, that in and of itself isn't really a full defense, because I would happily argue that Massa and Charles are products of their environments too. Doesn't mean I don't want to take them down, you know? Like, this is the Turtle Queen is kind of, I think, probably crossed that threshold for me as well of like, the excuses have sort of become irrelevant now. She just needs to be stopped because she's fucking scary.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess she's freed, and Rook is negotiating with her. Yeah, it's well, we'll get into it.
Yeah, before we get into it, well, I'll bring up like what I think is a fun point, which is I love that the Turtle Queen is like, oh, I'm free, and not in that like temporary way. They've actually like properly freed me. And then she looks around the room and realizes that like Rook has her and Basil positioned in such a way that she's still trapped in the room. Which like leans into Rook's whole positioning thing as well. But I just also think it speaks to like Rook's kind of hypocrisy about the way she goes about things, because she's undone the binding and what she would consider the toxic, terrible kind of trapping. But then she's just gone on to trap the Turtle Queen to the same extent, and it all but threatens to rebind her until a time where she would be useful again. So I just think it's interesting that like you can tell Rook thinks it's a big deal that she's undone like a practitioner's binding, but then she traps the Turtle Queen in essentially the same way and threatens to redo it if she doesn't agree to like hang out with them. Like it's we'll get into Rook a lot more later, but Rook just reeks of this sort of you know, as bad as the enemy she's fighting vibe for me right here.
Which is not great, and obviously everyone will pull this out soon enough. Another point in the Turtle Queen being evil column, as soon as she is freed, the first thing she does is like, I don't know the word to use, but I'm going to say dominate the Countdown Cassandra and the Type Tap Kitty, which is again very like, oh, that's just kind of gross.
Yeah, especially when we're going to get to Avery discussing the morality of possessing people with Bridge and shit.
Yes.
Using the Turtle Queen to take over and influence bugs, people, whatever. It's creepy. And again, to dunk on Rook, I can see why Rook chose the Turtle Queen, because I think there's a lot of similarities between those two.
Interesting.
Sorry, to answer Wobbo's question in the chat, I don't know if Rook necessarily thought the Turtle Queen would take them over or not. It doesn't matter to me. I still think it's telling us that the Turtle Queen sucks. And I think to get back to dunking on Rook, both of them are obviously very angry people, but we've seen Rook has this pattern of taking others and, you know, the justifiable ones, the like problematic ones, but essentially binding them, taking them, and then using them when appropriate as part of her game. And like, is that really that difference to what we just saw the Turtle Queen do with some of the others? I think the other thing I want to call out the Turtle Queen later on, one of her biggest powers is that she can kind of also take over and subvert practitioners' practice.
Yes.
Which feels like, again, a more condensed version of what Rook sort of does. So I think I think the Turtle Queen is an interesting first choice for Rook because she acts as this really interesting foil for Rook in that I think in some ways she's an almost worse example of who Rook is.
Yeah. It's just such an interesting... Because I think if the Countdown Cassandra and the Type Tap Kitty, it's very easy to be just fully on their, like, in their camp. You know what I mean? Like, they're very fun.
Yeah.
And they don't feel, like, evil, you know? I mean, Countdown Cassandra is clearly strong and clearly causes some damage and clearly has caused damage to people in the past, but, like, has the balance of, like, oh, you know... At least she tells one. I don't know. I mean, like, I guess it's the fact that she's not, she doesn't feel as openly malicious.
Yeah.
And also any maliciousness that I read from the Countdown Cassandra in this part of the chapter, in my head, I think I've just slotted into, well, it's because she's being influenced by the Turtle Queen. So the normal Countdown Cassandra, I'm sure is super chill.
Yeah. She just, you know, it catches people in these bad fates and only lets one person survive.
Yeah. No. I mean, Countdown Cassandra is definitely still pretty bad. But like, yeah,
she feels more at the whim of the role that she's in. Like, she's this servant of fate. I think that's the framing that makes it feel different to me. Is Countdown Cassandra feels like somebody who is having to act out this pattern or she die, whereas the Turtle Queen seems to relish in growing and causing violence.
Mm.
Also, yeah, as Fran points out in chat, the Countdown Cassandra looks really cool.
Mm.
And that's important.
Yeah. And you know what else? It feels like, you're right, it feels like the Countdown Cassandra kind of is more tapped into the universe in a way, or like is a more fair opponent, you know? It, or like more, yeah. I don't even know, like just. This is just kind of off the top of my head, but like that's definitely the feeling that you get from it. Just because it's more like there are more rules around what the Countdown Cassandra is doing. It's not like a just kind of going out there and having
you know what it is? To death. The Countdown Cassandra doesn't really reflect on morality at all. She's almost like freakishly amoral and how it's just like this is the fate and the disaster that like this is the pattern that will unfold. It's very divorced from responsibility for actions. Whereas the Turtle Queen is very much like, oh, I'm going to take over this shit and cause violence.
Yeah, Sengachi puts it well by saying that the Countdown Cassandra feels kind of like Alpi. And I think that's right.
Yeah.
It's like, but anyway, so then the kind of through line of this chapter is, to me, starting with the most detestable, I guess, and like malevolent, and then getting to the least over the course of the chapter, and then jumping back to Bridge and Avery at the end. And I just think that's an interesting kind of flow.
Yeah, I think because we're naturally sympathetic to others, this chapter really opens with the one who I would say is the most just morally off-putting in order to cause us to enter this mind space of questioning what tools we shouldn't use, because that's ultimately where we end up with Avery.
Mm.
I suppose before we leave like the whole Turtle Queen conversation behind us, I do just also want to call out Rook says she has plans to incorporate the Turtle Queen into Found Kennet. So I imagine we'll get to have a lot more of this talk later on, because this, like, that's gonna have to be a thing, I reckon. Like, the Turtle Queen, the way she takes over and subsumes stuff, her natural inclination towards violence, like, there's no way that she can just be a big part of it without some extreme caveats and stuff.
Yeah. And Rook obviously kind of talks about, hampering the Turtle Queen and changing what the Turtle Queen is, both kind of through the Turtle Queen's active decisions and through, you know, Rook's shenanigans. But even so, I don't know. we switch to the perspective of the Countdown Cassandra, who starts to move through the house and set up her disasters.
Yeah, what's even funny is before this conversation, I had written down my notes here. It's funny how the Countdown Cassandra is more likable than the Turtle Queen, despite being an entity of disaster and fate.
Yeah, so. I know. It's so strange. But you know, it's totally true. Speaking of being likable, I really liked Millie and America and how like quick on the uptake they were. Like, it's so fun in a story that's about, you know, about youth and younger practitioners and kind of comparing them to the older practitioners in this scene. And like Millie and America feel like they're actually like immediately on the uptake of what's going on. Whereas the older practitioners, I was like, how are they so bad at this? Like a strange other that they don't recognize just shows up and they're like, oh, shouldn't we deal with you?
Yeah.
Like, well, I don't know. I mean, obviously the others are kind of making their move and that's, you know, Cassandra's impacting connections and stuff. And like, obviously it's kind of like justifiable that the older practitioners are like, you know, not as quick on the uptake because of that. But still, it's so funny to me that, like, it's just a great marker of how the younger practitioners who are less kind of, I don't know, fully, like, set in the practitioner society or whatever.
Yeah.
Just are a bit more willing to kind of question things, you know?
Yeah, well, because the older practitioners just see Countdown Cassandra and they're like, can somebody take care of this son? Like, it's the reaction you get if you're at a big dinner party and you see like a dog running around.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, can somebody like take care of this dog that's biting people's ankles? Like it's a super dismissive and condescending sort of framing of how they treat it. Whereas all the kids tend to be like, hold on, like what's your deal?
I like what Mirth Strike said, framing this as, again, generationally, that to the older practitioners, others are like the help and just kind of like not a thing to, I don't know, they've been sorted into their box already, so they don't need to be worried about, you know?
I mean, it's a question of how long that becomes, till that becomes true for the younger practitioners as well.
Yeah.
The other sort of response I had down here for that is also we do have to keep in mind that these are all the, like the D-list older practitioners, like all the important people are like on the other side of the state or province, I think they call them in Canada. So it's like, you know, like people like America and Millie are only D-list in part because of their age.
Yes. Yeah. Which is fair still. Therefore, you know, the fact that these are, well, America's not that young, but Millie is quite young, right? Like,
I think they're about the same age.
Oh, really? For some reason, yeah. I have America as older in my head, but yeah, you're right.
I think they're both like 17-ish, 17, 18.
Okay, anyway, but, you know, they're still quite young comparatively.
Yeah. So well, yeah.
The fact that they're doing better, even in this playing field where it's kind of ridiculous. It's kind of ridiculous that they're doing better than these much older practitioners.
Yeah.
Yeah, I also like that Bridge kind of calls out, as Millie is pulling her shit, Bridge calls out, you let another free, one that many wanted bound, and this falters Millie's practice or maybe her strength. It was kind of ambiguous to me whether this was kind of Millie hesitating or her practice hesitating as a result of what she had done, but either way, it's wonderful, and Millie totally fucked up, and this chapter just like completely confirms that.
Who's getting the last house?
Did that come through?
Exactly. Yeah, no, yeah. That came through. Yeah.
I think it's because like, yeah, like the moment that you're talking about, it's this great moment where Millie almost seems like she's going to beat all of these others back because she starts to read, yes, and she's like, I'm a knight. I did all these totally cool missions for like higher powers. Like I have a important job and I'm calling on this power now to defend myself. And she starts to get powered up and you're like, oh shit. And then, yeah, Bridge just calls on, no, you just recently let one of them out, you dick shit.
Yeah.
And it completely undermines it. And it's like, yeah, that's what I totally would define karma as. Yeah.
It happened.
I loved it. Like, it's such a great moment to see her draw on the honor of her job and have someone like Bridge undermine that because she just did.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and this chapter confirms completely that she was being manipulated, right?
Yeah.
We'll get to that a little bit later. So, yeah, the practitioners eventually do notice what's going on, but it's too late. Countdown Cassandra's countdown reaches zero, lightning strikes, and the attack begins.
Yeah, and this is just, like, really cool. Like, seeing a trap like this get sprung.
Yeah.
It, like, you know, it's just fun in any context watching yeah, you know, the lightning strike, the lights go out. Like, you can see it visually as just like, you know, there's like flashes as we see people getting wrecked by bugs and stuff. It's just a cool moment.
Yeah, it's very cool. And ends with this section ends with the line, "And with that done, the Turtle Queen no longer held back. She took the house," which again is just like, oh yeah, God.
It's she's terrifying.
Doesn't feel good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, again, one of the other things that we haven't actually touched on with her, we saw in her origin story, she usually had multiple people she'd use as like part-time hosts, and she owns them even when they're not her hosts. Like, yeah. Is that part of the plan here? Like, just again, we're going to get to Avery questioning using stuff like Bridge, and I can't help but extend that 100 times more to everything to do with the Turtle Queen.
Yeah, it was a little, it felt to me, I was a little uncertain as to whether the Turtle Queen is actually like, is she similar to how she had the cult of people in turtle jerseys who slapped that, slapped that girl to nearly death? It, like, you know, that's what's happening here, right? That she's going to kind of start, I don't know, mind influencing them, which feels like it's like Bridge on a much worse level.
Yeah, there's definitely signs that she doesn't get to do that to these practitioners.
Yes,
in this house because of, well, basically the Bjorgman's influence. But I feel like she would if she could, and you know, this would tie into any potential role she's going to have in Found Kennet, really. Like what space is for her there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to talk this to death in a later episode.
Yeah. I think we'll see more Turtle Queen soon enough. So when Lucy meets the Turtle Queen, I'm sure there will be some choice words. So we switch perspectives again, following the Type Tap Kitty as they head out through a phone call to Musa.
And they are a technomancy fancy. Wanted to say that again.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that Musa is seeming to not be doing well as a leader. Like, there's a bit of a rebellion brewing, which is fun.
Sorry, I just, Walbo's just commented in the chat on the pronunciation of bug spelt with two G's and an E. I'd been pronouncing it like more like bug in my head, but bugger.
Bugger or bugger.
I can't do bugger because that's too close to
bugger.
Like bugger, like which it's just too commonly in my vocabulary is an Australian. yeah, bugger.
Bugger.
Anyway, I think we're almost through this section with them, so then it won't matter anymore, right? But yeah, no, it's like it's worth calling out, and I've seen a lot of people discuss this on like Reddits and Discords. The fact that Master even took Toronto is like a huge leap from where he said he was going in 14.z. And so as I think it's Grayson Henniger points out here, like either Musa is changing the plan as he's going or he's keeping it from everyone else and both of them suck. It's basically his point. And it's like, yeah, like this is the thing. Musa just doesn't care about anyone else enough to be a good leader, as he said.
Yeah, I think it's that he's just changing the plan and kind of mixing it up as he goes. But that really does demonstrate a kind of lack of his ability to actually realize how the plan is going to play out. Like,
yeah,
with all the augurs that he hired, he still didn't really know what was going to happen.
What's even worse is he has that moment where he's like, I think Grayson's like, look, I think a lot of them would just like someone who, you know, they could send a representative and you can talk to them and then that person could tell everyone else what's going on. Mm-hmm. And Musa's basically like, that sounds like bureaucracy and I don't want to have to deal with it. So we'll just like send somebody to take care of it as if it's an invasion. And if it's not, well, you know, we'll already have somebody who specializes in violence over there. Like it's just the whole thing, he just doesn't care about anyone else. And the idea of having other people who he has to explain and justify himself to, he just shuts it down.
Like, yeah. Just
dictatoring, basically.
Yeah. He's going to fail just from his inability to manage people, right?
Well, Rook and Bridge seem to be planning to help him with that.
Yeah. Well, let's get to that, shall we? So we switch back to Bridge and Avery is basically criticizing what they've been doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to talk about this part where, yeah, Rook and Bridge are like, I guess we'll have to help Musa. And it's just kind of like, this is so fucked.
How does Kennet keep ending up in this spot? Because Rook's basically, and I actually fully understand Rook's logic of, if Musa has a tenuous grasp on his own like hierarchy, he will have more to prove, he'll be more violent. So we want him super confident and arrogant, which is like, okay, so you want him to have all the power. I mean, I guess that's in a way better. Like, I can understand your flow of logic. But this turns into her and Bridge being like, yeah, so we're going to have to help prop Musa up a bit. And like, I just remember in like arc 13 feeling the same when they're like talking about like Musa versus the witch hunters and stuff. Like, Kennet has got to stop picking enemies where their role is to help them so that they can get more powerful so that they can take out the other enemies. Like, it's just, this is playing with fire. I understand the logic behind doing it, but like, oh God.
Yeah.
What a wild spot to be in.
It's worth pointing out that the fact that they, you know, were kind of helping Musa is directly led to Charles taking the throne, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So kind of troubling.
I mean, yeah, it's just an interesting spot they keep finding themselves in. And this touches on, I mean, okay, like, full disclosure for everyone listening right now, we recorded the reflecting episode for this arc yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked a lot about this topic. So I'm trying not to repeat myself too much, because when you listen to the reflecting episode in a few days, you will get to hear us go on about this particular aspect of things a bit. But just like Rook needing to, I think, reevaluate how she keeps ending up in this position where she's propping up enemies to be able to take them down later, despite the fact she always loses. Like, what? Yeah.
Yeah, it's yeah, I mean, I guess if Rook has never had a war go really successfully, maybe it's time for her to change the way she does things.
Yeah, and this is what I talked about a lot yesterday, just the idea that Rook needs to suck it up and take a back seat and stop making plans without consulting everyone else, because her plans suck. I mean, they're good, but also they suck.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're good up until the point where they don't work, right?
So. yeah. But
yeah.
I just really love this position, like Avery sitting opposite Rook too, because while I think Rook is too far one way, I actually think it would be fair to say that Ave is too far the other way. Ave is a little bit too naive and innocent for a war. And I just really enjoy seeing these two go at it, because I don't quite agree with either of them. I think Avery isn't hard enough to make the rough calls when you do need to, and I think Rook is too okay making the hard calls when you don't need to.
Yeah, I guess I would say, like, I feel like there's a lot more people on the side of more willing to make the hard calls than there are on Avery's side. I feel like Avery and Lucy maybe are the only two people pushing back against that.
And I would call into question any team that didn't have an Avery. I think you,
yes, exactly,
need somebody who's saying, hey, look, we did that, but it was shit, and we only did it because we had to, and we should feel bad.
Yeah.
Like, the point where you become like Rook and you're just sort of okay with, well, you know, we're going to use Bridge because we need to, without it being even a question, like, that's where the concern comes in for me.
Yeah. Yeah, like, Rook in her head only has two options, and it's either, well, we can either murder everybody or we can do another thing. And if it's not as bad as murdering everybody, then it's great. So you can't complain. And it's kind of like, no,
yeah,
that's not how it works.
Yeah, I could have done it worse is a shit argument, Rook.
Yeah. I do like the confirmation that Bjorkman still just fully had a grasp on all three of those kids that were released. Yep. And Millie is just 100% a piece of shit that was conned, clearly. I mean, we all knew it, obviously. Yeah. Anywho, that's the end of arc 16. Let's get into 17, Gone and Done It with Lucy.
Now they gone chapter, and done it.
Like, now they gone and done it.
What an arc title.
So yeah, Lucy, Verona and Avery are watching as a meteor heads straight for Kennet, and Alpie is commenting on how little she has needed to change for this nightmare.
Yeah, they're all in sync. It's nice. I really enjoy seeing an Alpi nightmare that's just like mostly a fun, like synchronized view of the town from our three Kenneteers. Usually it's much more like we get a peek at each of their own nightmares, whereas I really enjoy the different vibes you get from this one where they're all on the same page.
Yeah, but that page is worrying because they all seem to be very anxious about a disaster about to strike. And it's the meteor's faceless, which to me implies they don't fully know exactly what the disaster is going to be, just that it's coming for Kennet and everybody within it soon enough.
Oh, I just assumed that's because it was Miss.
Oh, really? Interesting. But then Miss comes out afterwards, right?
Yeah, when the meteor lands.
I see what you're saying.
Like, because I just thought that was a particularly funny way to describe a meteor, because I was like, well, meteors don't typically have faces.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they've described Miss as a meteor in this plan at some point a while ago. So I assume that was what this was leaning into.
I don't know. Do you think that, like, I don't see Miss... I see Miss as going to have an impact, and I don't necessarily know, well, I guess meteors have impacts too, but I don't necessarily know, like, if she's going to be a positive or negative force, you know what I mean?
Well, that's very much what we're calling into question in this chapter, I think, yeah, is, I mean, there's a moment where, like, the sort of, the bloodiness on Miss's hand leaks out from her model in this dream, which I think is very much tying into that doubt there, is even the Kenneteers are a bit like, they have their doubts, I guess.
Yeah, fair enough. I would like to see Kaiju Miss in real life. I think that'd be very fun.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what physical changes happen to Miss if she becomes the Lys equivalent of found Kennet. What physical changes would accompany something like that?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, becoming giant, I guess, is the answer.
I mean, it could be worse. But I love how Alpi just almost right at the start of this chapter quickly addresses the topic of not what I assume is not just this chapter, but what will be the entire arc. In fact, you know, it's just been one of the major themes of the story since Arc 12, which is when Alpi says to them, you're all feeling that identical way. I'm going to do an accent for this one. You're all feeling that identical way about this. So how come you're standing so far apart? Which is just like, that's been the problem with Kennet for so long now, right? Is they're all kind of on the same page, but also in very different places.
Yeah.
And Alpi's just starting to call that out overtly. And it leads the Kenneteers to start talking about this themselves. And there's this great moment where Avery says, are we fine? Is Kennet? And Lucy goes on to answer about how fine Kennet is, completely disregards the first half of the question.
Yeah.
This is like, there's sort of really two big things that get juggled in this conversation and quickly become established as stuff for this arc. There's obviously all the moral stuff that we're going to get into a lot, but something else that comes up here is like the Kenneteers have obviously been, you know, separated for quite a few arcs now, both like physically and also kind of friendship wise.
Yeah.
And we are starting to see what it's going to look like as they come back together. And I'm just so interested to see what shape that takes, because there's a lot of really great moments in this conversation where it feels like you're just reading three friends chatting again. Like, there's that great moment where Verona describes the milkmaid is like a 5 out of 10, and then Lucy and Avery start giving her shit, and then she has to go like, look, the point is, and it just felt like a great friend moment. But then there's still a lot of that, you know, awkwardness, acknowledgement they're not on the same page, like things are still a little bit bumpy, and I can't wait to see how we try to put them together again while admitting that they're not going to be exactly the same.
Yeah, definitely. It's They're just, I don't know, the dynamic of this group, it feels like it's still in flux and we don't know what it's going to look like when it's finished, I suppose. Yeah.
And because I remember early in the story, like, you know, it started to feel like they were getting borderline telepathic, like they were always so on the same page. And now that we've moved into like the more complicated part of the story, that almost feels antithetical to what Pale is really about, which is this idea of being able to work together despite not being the same. And I love that that's become a really central thing for the Kenneteers themselves. Like, they're all acknowledging that they want to work together, but they're on different pages and they're trying to figure out how the fuck they can reconcile those two facts, not just for themselves, but for like Kennet and the practitioner community as a wider whole.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can't wait for Wabo to give us the answer.
I'm sure we'll get some answers soon enough.
Also, last thing I really wanted to call out from just the opening of this dream, we get told where each Kenneteer is standing in town. And obviously Verona's at the house on Half Street, makes sense. Avery's home base is apparently where she did the Forest Ribbon Trail ritual. And then Lucy's standing on top of the arena, which is just, it is interesting how much Lucy has really grown a connection to the arena as this like place that really is the symbol of their loss. I'm interested if that's going somewhere or what that represents, because I just find it fascinating that she would continue to tie herself seemingly by choice to this place that really signifies where she lost everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's messed up, the concept of the arena being so core to, core to her growth moments, I suppose.
Yeah, Lapsed Castlessness brings up a great point, which is also, like, obviously the arena word means something else for Lucy, which is, you know, yes, her Fae Duelist arena.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's an important part of, as Lucy, like, Lucy's the one whose journey since the end of Arc 13 has been the most about, like, learning to cope with loss and really build yourself back and figure stuff out. And I think the fact that she's constantly drawing herself back to the arena means something for that.
Mm. Yeah. So, yeah, the trio takes stock of how they're doing and how the Kennet others are doing. And, yeah, you know, things aren't in a great place.
I love how Lucy... So Verona has this whole thing with the assignment. She hasn't finished the assignment. It's due today. And when she finds this out, Verona's like, okay, fuck, can you wake me up early? Maybe I can squeeze it through. And Lucy opens her response to this with, okay, number one, first thing, I'm not your fucking mum. And my response to reading that coming from Lucy was just, well, 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 how the turntables turn. Because that was, like, that used to be Verona's chip on her shoulder that Lucy was acting like her fucking guardian. So I think I just really enjoyed seeing Lucy throw that back at her face, because I think Verona, Verona just kind of had to accept it in a very fun way.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good moment. Can we talk about, I mean, this is a comedy beat, but I think it's still worth talking about. Verona calls being forsworn a 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even necessarily disagree. I just think it's very interesting that Verona, whose whole vibe is like, oh, the practice is like my whole jam, she only puts it a 7, which is like, I don't know, it kind of almost feels like a growth moment of like, man, Verona accepts that, you know, at least she'd still be alive. At least she'd still have things going. There's worse stuff that could happen.
See, I read it as exactly the opposite.
Oh, no.
Because I still had in my head the whole Brett saying the dishes were a 10 out of 10 emergency.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw this as like her, like, overcorrecting, trying not to catastrophize for her friends. So she's like underrating everything because she doesn't want to seem like a drama queen. When, in my opinion, getting forsworn is a fate worthy of some drama.
Like, yeah. Yeah. No, I really think, you know what? I think I said this last time. I think Verona getting forsworn would be so fun for this story.
I know. I think we did talk about this, and I had the same thought. I was reading this, and I was like, oh, it'd throw so much off kilter, but, like, fuck, seeing Verona get forsworn would just be a juicy story element. But, yeah, like, I mean, Verona refuses to tell the others that she's even going to get forsworn, which is...
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I've come down on her communication skills a lot over the past 2 years, but this, like, just continues to be a fucking thorn in her side.
Yeah, it's funny to me that she doesn't bring it up. It's really...
Well, she says she doesn't want them to stress, which is, like, again, it's just, it's this classic overcorrecting on what her father does.
Yeah. Oh, Verona. What a character.
And I mean, this particularly felt like prescient to me because there were these really big moments of character growth for Verona in her domain ritual at the end of the last arc. Like, it really felt like she hit some sort of turning points. And obviously, I didn't think that would take the form of Verona is fixed now, quote unquote. Mm. But it is also worth noting that her domain ritual is, to an extent, incomplete. So it kind of fits that even the growth moments she had during the domain ritual are, at the moment, a little bit incomplete, basically.
Mm.
Because, yeah, she's still waiting on Lost Kennet to come so she can actually finish off her domain ritual. And I imagine that when she finishes it off, there'll be a sort of another moment of her kind of moving forward a little bit in her own journey.
Yeah. I think she's on the path, at least.
Getting there.
She's getting there, slowly but surely. Speaking of people being on the path, we get confirmation Alpi confirms to the Kenneteers, that the Milkmaid set Ralph on his path, which is great. Another great setup for the Milkmaid as, like, clearly somebody who is actively contributing to the worst parts of the system, right? So not just a murderer, but also a cog in the machine of, like, the fucked upness of practitioner society.
Well, expressly somebody who, through their fucked upness, spreads it. Yeah, like truly a 5 out of 10. Horrifying, this one.
Yeah, a real 5 out of 10. They're really making some bad deals here, I think.
Yeah, well, this is where we really start to get into what it feels like we're really setting this arc up to discuss off the back of the end of arc 16, which is the Kenneteers feel like they're really being challenged to decide where their lines are for stuff. Like, what is the line that they're willing to draw? And I think, you know, this is pale. I don't think it would be as simple as, like, you draw one line anywhere. But, like, the Kenneteers are being caused to question, like, when is something like the Milkmaid okay? They specifically talk about, like, Abraham versus Raquel versus Reed Musser. Like, at what point are they bad people versus someone like Raquel, who presumably hasn't had a chance to get better?
Mm-hmm.
At what point can you say, no, go fuck yourself, Abraham, versus, Reed, even? Like, Reed felt like he was very much on the threshold, and he got there in the end under duress. This is really what Arc 16 challenged us with at the end, and what Arc 17 seems to be diving into full bore is, where are your lines? What can you condone in what circumstances? And the Kenneteers are really having to confront that head on as they start to build Lost Kennet. And that's just incredibly juicy.
I'm really digging this question taking the forefront more. I think that'll be really fun.
Yeah, like, this Arc 17 has quickly set itself up to be a really interesting sequel to Arc 17 in this way. Like, 16 felt like it really started to raise these questions, and 17 is now demanding answers to them. Because I don't think we've ever seen, like, we've talked, like, in the fandom and on this podcast a lot about, like, is what Miss did okay? Is what John did okay? Like, it's stuff fans have been able to talk about for ages. I don't think we've seen the Kenneteers overtly discuss, hey, can we abide Miss? Can we abide Toad Sawyer? Until very recently. So this is such an interesting escalation to something that's been on, I think, their subconsciouses, but now they're having to really think about it.
Yeah. I guess we'll continue that conversation.
Quantum Hacker in our chat has described what we're asking as what actions are beyond the pale, which I really like.
Yes, that's very good. We're jumping forward, and Lucy is training with Bracken and Guillemet, and Guillemet's deterioration is getting worse and worse, which is apparently very enticing for Melissa.
Oh, Guillemet's just, it's quickly getting to the point where I just can't stand him. Like, he actually, just when I see Guillemet's coming up on the page, I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, he's gotten under my skin with how unnecessarily strict and arbitrary he's gotten.
Yeah. The injury's getting longer and longer is, like, a clear mark of winter, right? falling over like his whole vibe.
Yeah.
Which is messed up. And then there's this part at the end where Guillaume is basically using Lucy as a weapon to injure Bracken to teach him a lesson. And it's just so fucked. Like, definitely, Lucy, it's time to bail on these lessons. Which is funny that Melissa is like, this is the time I should try and jump in more.
Yeah. Yeah, it does really feel like Lucy needs to reevaluate her relationship with Guillaume. Because she kind of wasn't getting taught by him anymore, and then she kind of became an active student again because Bracken wanted to sign up, and that was, like, the requirement.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that just doesn't seem to have been a good trade, for starters.
I don't know. I mean, also, I'm sure they got some good lessons in there, but, I don't know.
I just also can't help but think that part of it is, obviously, we've talked to death about, you know, Lucy and her... the way she works through father figures pretty damn quickly. And Guillaume, despite who he is now, is one of the few she's got left. And I wonder how much she is clinging on to trying to keep Guillaume into her life out of this vibe of, like, he's one of the only men left and she can't quite accept that he's gone yet, basically.
Mm-mm. Yeah. She needs to hold on to all of her father figures as much as she can, I suppose.
Yeah. I just think because Guillaume is around, it makes it harder for her to realize that he's already gone. Although that said, he uses, like, the Winter Court and the Wild Hunt a lot as an excuse for, like, explaining why he has to do it. He's like, oh, you know, if word got hold that you besmirched the Winter Court, like, blah, 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 blah. Like, he's almost never saying he believes in any of the shit that's happening or all these rules for Winter. He refuses to say that he thinks they're sensible. He always just uses the court as a wider hole to blame them.
Yeah.
And that was something that Lucy, like, challenged a little bit early on. And I just wonder if we need to go back to, challenging that for Guillaume. And, you know, he said he'd get violent, but that, like, he's just constantly using it as an excuse. And I think we got to tell him to either accept, like, own his actions or, you know, get over it.
Mm. Yeah. Guillaume. Guillaume gets left behind by the group as they head to school, and they're just kind of chit-chatting as they go. Of course, the highlight of this is Bracken and Melissa continuing to be the OTP.
The fucking shoulder ride. I love how Melissa just instantly is like, Lucy, seriously, shut the fuck up. When Lucy calls
so it. Good. So good.
God, part of me almost thinks Lucy tagging out and letting Melissa be the second Guillaume student isn't the worst idea.
No, it's terrible. It's a terrible idea.
Yeah. Oh, don't get me wrong. I didn't say it's a good idea. I said it's not the worst idea.
Sure. I'm sure just, I can think of worse ideas.
Yeah. You know, it's a 6 out of 10 bad idea. But no, like Mel volunteering for training with Guillaume does feel like a really natural extension of the stubbornness she had to, like, become an aware, you know, like she was that pain in our ass for such a huge chunk in the story because she refused to let shit go and she would rather suffer and hurt herself than, like, give up on something. And that actually does kind of feel like the sort of student Guillaume is after.
Yeah.
So would it be good for her? No. Would they, you know, get on well? I think kind of, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not enough for me. we get some interesting notes here as well that, like, Verona's relationships are getting messed up by how much she's relying on the fetch. Like, Mel's figured it out, but for the people that aren't aware, it seems pretty clear to me that the fetch is doing some pretty serious social damage here.
Which is not really news or a surprise.
No, but we know that that's been happening with Jeremy, but I don't know. It's just kind of like, you gotta stop Verona.
Getting it reaffirmed to us in 17.1 in a Lucy chapter feels like it's just the story really going it out of its way to remind us, hey, remember the fetch and how it's, like, you know, potentially not a good form of escapism? I don't know. This whole angle of stuff with Verona continues to just be like a weird thing for me where I see both the good and the bad, and I can't decide whether I'm okay with her pursuing things like the Undercity the way she has or not, because it's clearly been good for her in some ways, but it's also just playing with fire in others.
Yeah, yeah, it's worrying stuff.
Yeah, I mean, the other side here, though, that's slightly more positive is Melissa finally asks, like, Lucy, is Verona avoiding me? And, like, Lucy, without kind of giving too much away, is basically able to say, well, you know, she gives her the lowdown on the whole drug dream, basically, without so many words, and sort of says, yeah, she's avoiding you because she doesn't want that to become true. And I'm just super interested to see if Melissa is going to confront Verona with this and what that would look like, because I feel like Verona has to let go of trying to avoid that prophecy in order to actually avert it. And it'd just be so kind of weirdly hilarious if Melissa is a big part of how she breaks past that.
Because
like the fact is, yeah, Melissa is doing a lot better. She's made connections. Like, she's essentially Lucy's friend now. She's got Bracken. Like, in a way, Melissa's come out of it already through her connections to people, and that's the thing Verona's tossing away to try and avoid it. And I wonder if, yeah, just of all people, Melissa's going to be the one to get that through to Verona.
Yeah. Yeah, true. God, Melissa's such a great character.
She really is.
So, yeah, Lucy and Grandfather attempt to bargain with Killwagon to make him not so violent, and he really doesn't seem to give a shit.
He gives zero shits.
Yeah.
I find him really frustrating on one level, because essentially his argument boils down to just being bullshit rules lawyering. Like, he's constantly like, oh, there's no hard written traffic laws, so I can do whatever the fuck I want. Yes. And Grandfather's like, can you just not be a dick though? And he's like, there's no rules, I can do whatever I want. And it's like, no, because that's the sort of thinking that gets us with super bureaucratic spelled out rules that you just will start trying to rules lawyer out of anyway. Like, it just...
Yeah.
Yeah. But then also, he's fucking hilarious.
He's so fun. His whole vibe is so much fun. Oh, my God.
I loved how, like, because he's just very upfront and, like, shit-stirry.
Yeah. And he's clearly just having such a good time, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah.
Like the bit where he's clearly just saying shit to make Miles, that's it. To make Miles laugh where he pulls out the ones who walk away from Omelus reference just to kind of fucking troll Lucy. It's great.
Yeah, I called that out, that line out earlier. It's like, that's my favorite line in the chapter, because like not only is that a really astute reference for what the story is dealing with right now. Like, we've been talking about all this stuff so heavily. He also, like, turns it into a joke about his wheelchair.
About his wheelchair, yes. Like, it's so good.
There's so many levels it's operating on. It's just an insanely clever line. So prescient. And again, just the fact that we're getting an Omelas reference from a boogeyman is just hilarious to me. Like, having this boogeyman who carries his trailer of weapons around tell you to read more is just funny.
Oh my god, what a great character.
I also love the bit where the person whose stall he wrecked is like, if you give me a weapon, like, that's okay, I'll like forgive you or whatever. I consider that reparations. And he's like, will you say it was a shit location? And they're like, will it get me a better weapon? He's like, sure. And then the store person's like, it was a shit location. And Killwagon just like turns around to Lucy and he's like, it was a shit location. It's just like, you cheeky cunt. Like, what a piece of shit. I love it.
Yeah.
I can see why he's friends with goblins.
Yeah. Oh, and he's a great fit for the market because he clearly collects horrifying weapons and tools. So he's just like very natural.
I mean, compared to the milkmaid, he's a pretty, like, as far as moral boogeymen go, he seems about as close as you're going to get, right?
Yeah, he talks about how he used to kill when he was trying to figure stuff out, but he stopped doing that since.
And it's as soon as he realized he didn't have to, he stopped.
Yeah, totally. Like, oh, you're actually great as a character.
like a really interesting wrinkle in this whole debate about moral lines and stuff, because it would have been kind of easy to look at like the milkmaid and some dude called Killwagon and be like, okay, let's like not let Boogeyman in.
Yeah.
But like, he makes a pretty compelling case for Boogeyman who should be allowed to be let in.
Yeah. He feels like he's a better fit for Kennet than the Milkmaid or the Turtle Queen.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, this it also ties into something Lucy brought up in the dream that we didn't touch on, which is a wrinkle to all of this where do you draw the line stuff is how far back does something have to be before you can forgive it? Yes. Like, do we hold Guillaume responsible for evil shit he did 500 years ago? Do we hold Killwagon responsible for killing people 60 years ago when he was confused, had just escaped what sounds like a pretty shit place, and thought he had to kill to stop from going back to hell? Yeah, like the God, what's that legal term for how long before stuff stops being stuff you can get put in jail for?
Statute of limitations,
that's it, yeah. What's the statute of limitations on all of these crimes is really interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
How much do you have to have demonstrated you've changed to get away with shit?
I mean, I feel like I don't want to get into this convo too much because I feel like we're going to talk about it a lot more in this chapter. So, yeah, Lucy chats to Bubble Yum, who gives her some advice on how to handle these types.
Yeah, and he's yet another character who has something to say on the theme of the arc where she says, "We're all jerks. The trick is you get enough jerks together in agreement and you get to make the rules to manage the other jerks. Sometimes you pick on jerks, sometimes you try to make things better. Usually, that one doesn't work," which is just like this really dim, pessimistic view of, yeah, the current conundrum of the story, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I find this really interesting coming off the back of the previous Lucy chapter, which is her choosing to be kind to Wallace, right? This advice from Bubble Yum, and similarly the advice she got from Rook in that chapter, is the exact opposite of, like, let's be more brutal, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just, it's such a fun setup for the moral dilemma of this chapter.
Yeah, because Bubble Yum is really just making the case that there are some people who won't respond to anything but
violence.
The firm arm of the law. And to an extent, she's right. But then the trick there can often be like, well, what are the rules and laws that we're enforcing? Like, the thing with Killwagon that he brought up is that he can eat food to survive, but he also needs to either kill people or scare the shit out of them. And it's a bit like, okay, well, like, he's going to naturally buck against rules that prevent him from scaring people because he kind of needs that to survive. So you either basically hammer down on him, which kind of seems unfair, or you try to figure out a set of rules where he can do that, I guess, like let him run a haunted house or some shit. I don't know.
Yeah. I'm sure they'll be able to find a way. I mean, it's what they were talking about with Chloe and Nibble of, like, how can we ethically source human meat? I'm sure there's a way to do it.
Yeah, I'm easily impressed. Brings up, there's the whole Rook transformation angle, although my understanding is that the shit she takes from people has to go somewhere. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, as you said, we'll get to talk about this a lot over this arc, I'm sure. The other important thing that Bubble Yum does here that is worth calling out is she basically threatens the Kenneteers if they hurt Toadie. She does the whole, he really cares about you and I really care about him. So
yeah, so don't fuck it up.
Like, yeah, classic sort of veiled threat vibe. But she does also, you know, say, hey, listen, he loves to teach and so does DD. And I can teach some goblin dueling. And I genuinely do think it would be fun to see Lucy take her up on that and get some complimentary stuff to her fey dueling, while also, very importantly, getting to see Guillaume's reaction to learning that Lucy's also doing goblin dueling on the side. Because he won't take that well.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see if that pans out. I don't know. It's interesting.
It's worth pointing out, Fran has said in our chat that Melissa should take Bubble Yum up on being a goblin duelist, which I actually really like.
That is an interesting one. I like that too.
Power couple, Bracklin the fey duelist, Melissa the goblin duelist.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. That'll be a fun relationship. So yeah, Lucy decides to choose a new council member who can represent Kennet. The only person who she feels is up to the task, Louise.
Louise, somebody who's famously up for things.
Yeah,
I mean, I do genuinely, though, love this idea so much. Like, especially as we create Found Kennet and really sort of up the representation of the magical aspects of Kennet in its build-up, it really does make sense to let the Council of Kennet above lean a bit more towards, like, humanity and the aware, and Louise is such a great choice for them. She's such a marked difference from everyone we've seen in the story. And giving an aware a position of power is just a huge, huge change from the way we've seen them treated by everyone else in the story. Like, it's, yeah, I love this idea.
Yeah. It's great, isn't it? Like, I love the bit where they're talking about how Louise met Ken and really liked him. And Lucy's like, you love Kennet. And it's just like, this is so awesome. It's such a powerful start to the chapter, I suppose. Such a powerful, especially considering what we know we're going to be dealing with in this chapter. It's such a powerful marker of what the Kenneteers want, which is they want to do legit good shit. They want to find unconventional ways to solve these problems that seem like they're really going to work quite well.
Yeah, and moving Kennet above's focus to humanity hasn't taken the form of practitioners or innocents who already have too much power. It's taken the form of the aware and people who don't have baggage in history. It's such a great idea. Like, this, you know, I'm starting to, because I've been internally second guessing the choice of grandfather as a replacement for Charles a lot in my head, but I might start to cut Lucy some more slack if she's making decisions like this, because actually it's a great one.
Yeah, it is. It's a great decision.
I mean, it is worth calling out from Louise's perspective. She does remind us how fucking dog shit she is as taking care of herself. So there is an interesting angle to this of, is this going to be good for Louise? Will this help her get help? Will she treat, like, Louise has a bad track record of taking care of herself. Is this going to make that worse, better, keep it the same? I think unless it's making it better, like, I don't know. I don't know how good an idea this actually is.
Yeah, I guess we'll see how it turns out in practice, but
yeah,
I don't know. I have faith.
I'm optimistic that it will be good for Louise as well. She'll actually find something in here that will, like, give her something to take care of herself for. People in the chat are already comparing it to Melissa and Sir. I really like that comparison.
And that's the lead-in to Arc 17, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really fun arc.
Between the ethical conundrums we're already getting hit with and the title Gone and Done It, like, this...
Yeah, I know, right? Like, what's the it that they're going to have gone and done? The start with the meteor really makes it seem like it's going to be something bad.
I can't wait.
But yeah, I guess that wraps up these chapters. Let's get into some pale predictions that we've pulled out from the community. Elliot, do you want to start with your prediction?
Yeah, I'll go first. I've pulled a prediction from I'm Easily Impressed, who's basically predicted that Lucy's going to start integrating music into her practice more. And they basically have, like, a big list of reasons why they feel this makes sense. Like, obviously she's got the earring as her implement. She's been playing John's guitar more recently. Music has always been a big thing for her. And she even made a comment in 16.10, I think it was, in the domain ritual about how this place would be even cooler with music. So basically, I'm Easily Impressed is just pulling all those threads together and saying that as she matures as a practitioner, she's going to use music more. So maybe integrate cool background music into her Fae Duelist arenas. Incorporate some sort of music component to some of the curses she puts on people. Like, in general, she just really associates music as being something that helps her connect with herself. That makes sense. And I just, I have pretty much already decided this is 100% true in my head. You've been asking for music-based practice for years now, Ruben, so...
I have.
I feel like you were just ahead of the curve on this one. You saw it coming.
Maybe. We'll see. I think it's cool. I definitely think it would be very cool. We shall see. Maybe her and Nora can start a band. Now, I realized about 2 minutes ago that I'd forgotten to pull out a prediction, which means let's move on to the discussion question answers for this week. So, yeah, we've been running a discussion question for the past 2 weeks, which was, what's the deal with Pisces and Hazel? Which has obviously been, everyone's been thinking about it for the past few weeks on the Reddit and with Wildo's cryptic hints and Reddit posts, Snowdrop's tiny fans, and yours. Let's get into some of these answers. I think a lot of these, we should probably preface by saying a lot of these theories are very in-depth and there's a lot to like put together. So we won't, I don't think we can get into all the evidence that everyone has in all of their theories because we'd be here for like 2 hours.
No, I think it's like a doof staple to say we had to condense discussion question answers down, go read the whole thing. Like,
yeah,
we sort of often say that, but now more than ever, we're literally like, we were getting 2,000 word discussion questions. We just literally can't go through them all.
But we'll kind of give a bit of summaries and our thoughts on some of them. I think there's a fair amount of overlap between them as well, like, which is fine because, you know, we're all reading from the same story, so there's inevitably going to be some overlap. But yeah, we'll kind of call them out and talk about parts that we liked and all that stuff. Should we start with the White Duke? Great.
I do want to
word great document.
It reminded me of some of those, like, so the White Duke sent us two versions of their theory, the summarized Word doc and then a comment elaborating. And the Word doc is very much a, like, those early 2000s really unhinged homemade HTML websites, you see.
Loved it.
Like, it felt almost as much like a call for help as it did a discussion question answer.
Yeah, I was expecting that there would be some music auto-playing as I scrolled through the doc, but I don't think Google Docs have that technology yet.
But then they went on to elaborate that this, like, the shitpost doc was actually their, like, a summary of their real theory, which was that, you know, Pisces was from, like, an alternate reality or another world of some kind. And, like, this is definitely where my head was after reading the chapter for the first time, because the pillar ritual had this sort of first contact-y, getting each other in sync vibe.
It really does. It reminded me a lot of Arrival, right? It gives a lot of that same vibe, which I think the White Duke kind of pulled into Aliens or something extraterrestrial, extra-dimensional or whatever, right?
Yeah, like I don't think I was alone in being one of those people who read it and thought, oh, was he an alien or something? And what the White Duke did is actually went and followed through on that and kind of compiled all the evidence into a pretty compelling case. And I really like this theory.
I quite like it too. I don't know if it's correct, just from a meta perspective of it would feel pretty wild to introduce aliens into this story. Yeah. But I did like it.
Yeah, I agree. Although in saying that, the edge of the paths is where I would expect aliens to be. Like the edge of our paths intersecting with theirs. Like if anywhere was going to have first contact, it was going to be the ends of the paths. But yeah, I mean, this theory, I guess to touch into some of the meta stuff, like obviously Wildo gave 9 questions to sort of answer. And the area of it that this feels a bit divorced from for me is how it fits into Hazel's journey.
Yeah.
I think this does feel like a great fit for some of the facts we get about Pisces and the way the ritual works, but I don't see that link to Hazel, if that makes sense. So I don't know, I still really like this theory though.
Yeah, definitely. I think, so Alternative Arrival was bringing up reflections as a recurring motif, which I think a lot of people latched onto. So Pact Versa talks about Pisces' world being kind of the inside-out version of ours, and Pisces is the mirror of Hazel. Dabaran talks about Pisces as an alternate version of Hazel. And then Snowdrop's Tiny Fan, I think, is the theory that really takes this idea and runs with it the furthest. Yeah.
Who would have guessed that the longest, best, and most like well-sourced theory would come from Snowdrop's Tiny Fan?
No, who could have imagined? Yeah, but you know, this one is, there's a long Reddit post about it, so you can read it. But yeah, it's latching onto Wabo's clue of the difference between my and Snowdrop's Tiny Fan interprets that as it's not, there's not a path or the paths, but my paths. They're very much tied to the person who is exploring them. And Pisces is a personalized reflection of the practitioner, of the finder, and kind of a guide that is built from the finder. And then as a deeper level goes into the interpretations of the ending and Pisces' disappearance and all kinds of stuff. I loved it. So good, right? So good.
Yeah. It's definitely one of the most compelling theories. To talk about how it touches on like all nine of those questions, I think it's got pretty solid answers for most of them.
Yes.
It's a really good one. We also got like one that I think was like a sort of our discussion thread exclusive, as far as I could tell, mm-hmm. from Propaganda Pagoda.
Yep.
And I really liked reading this theory, but I have to admit, I'm not 100% sure what the theory actually is. Like, I can't give you the one sentence summary because there's a lot of really interesting
concepts and
facts about how like how Pisces as a being relates to what he represents astrologically.
Yes.
And they bring up the idea of Hazel's figure eight being a Mobius strip. And that ties into some other stuff in a really cool way. So they're like, what's a really cool idea? But it kind of went over my head, this theory of what they're actually saying Pisces is, I suppose.
I couldn't pull out the grand unifying statement of it for sure. But there's a lot of very interesting things in there, like interesting imagery and real world analogs from astrology, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then your theory, Elliot.
Yeah, why don't, you know, I'm obviously biased. Why don't you tell us about my theory, Rube? Being the good friend that you are, I assume you've read it cover to cover.
I did read it, of course. Of course I read it. So I guess I would sum up your theory as saying, like, here's the summary of the theory. Pisces is, as one of these architects, a kind of deeper manifestation of the paths itself as an entity, right? And the paths are, I think you latched on quite heavily to the idea of the paths being like the childlike, you know, and being a manifestation of kind of childlike ideas. And then the journey of being on the paths is the journey of, I guess, growing up. Something I really liked about your theory, Elliot, is tying the paths as a thing that is kind of trying to come of age to the fact that this is in some ways a coming of age story for the Kenneteers, which on a like meta thematic level was really great, I think.
I'm not going to lie. A big part of how I went about putting the theory together was I figured like the sections of the chapter dealing with Pisces and the ritual had been analyzed to death.
Mm.
So I was coming in so late to the game. I was like, I'm going to look at Hazel's part of the journey, and I read like the other part of the chapter, and then I reread the book that Avery read like two chapters earlier, because I figured that was that was when Hazel was first introduced, and I was like, well, this is presumably Wabo seeding shit. So the basis of how I went about it was very much to read the shit around what had already been analyzed to death.
Yeah, but I think I do quite like a lot of parts to it. I think you started to draw ideas about what does this mean for Lost Kennet? Does this mean we can find a way to have the paths grow without necessarily growing up and changing?
I think, like, obviously I'm a bit biased, but I think there are parts of my theory I obviously really like, but I do think, like, to compare it to, say, something like Snowdrop's Tiny Fan, I think hers does a better answer of, like, a better job of answering a lot of the questions around Pisces. Like, if I was to sort of redo my theory, I reckon I'm still quite confident on all my read on the paths and sort of that macro stuff, but I reckon if you told me that the part of my theory that's wrong is exactly what Pisces meant to Hazel and what happened to him, it wouldn't surprise me much. I think, like, theories like Snowdrop's Tiny Fan cover that end of it a lot better.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think STF's theory has a very nice kind of unifying through line, which is difficult to pull off to such a strong degree.
Yeah.
But that's all our discussion question responses. Next week, we're going to do a slightly simpler and less complex discussion question. What animal mask would you choose for an honorary Kenneteer? So yep. we've got a number of candidates for next for the fourth Kenneteer, you know.
Yeah, Snowdrop's one of them, but I don't think
Snowdrop would be cheating, that's, of course.
Yeah. But obviously like
unless people, you can justify why Snowdrop's mask wouldn't be an opossum mask. That'd be an interesting yeah. one.
Ibis is the only other one that I think works for her.
Mm.
But yeah, like we've got a bunch of honorary Kenneteers at this point. I think Liberty's one. People like Fernanda and Raquel are certainly applicants. You've got Melissa. Yeah, this obviously came up because Melissa, this chapter, decided that her mask was a dragon. And I think that is a terrible fucking idea for her, but I'm curious to see what people think. Yeah. Yeah, Bracken, I think, is almost an honorary Kenneteer. Jeremy, yeah?
Yep.
So, yeah, what animal mask would you choose for some of our honorary Kenneteers?
Yeah.
We'll save the discussion question around morality for later in this arc, because I'm sure we'll get to talk it to death.
Yeah, definitely. If you have answers to this discussion question, you can put them in our discussion thread, which will be linked in the show notes down below.
Yep. Don't forget to check out our Twitter, too. We're still posting daily memes there of varying quality.
But varying quality means some of them are really good, so it's a plus. If you want, you can head to doofmedia.com to get all the info on all the shows on the Doof Media Network, including...
We can't talk about it yet, I don't think.
Never mind, then.
Well, I think we could say there's something coming soon. Keep your eye on the doofmedia.com website.
Yes.
Yeah, there's something new coming there. Honestly, I think later today.
Yes, I think it is today.
So by the time you're listening to this, if you're not listening live, it might already be there and we could have talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
If you want to support... if you want to support the Doof Media Network, you can become a patron at patreon.com/doofmedia. Becoming a patron gives you access to all kinds of perks depending on your support level, but also, of course, just means that you're supporting this show, and that's great. So thank you if you're a patron.
Yep, and don't forget to stop by Wildbo's Patreon, patreon.com/Wildbo, or he'll get the Turtle Queen to slap you.
Mm-hmm.